on the team that was monitoring what was going on there. So if you could give your sense, both to, you know, with what's going on here domestically with legislation, how it relates to Copenhagen, and how all this relates to the climate system itself, that would be great.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And, you know, let me say, I am a veteran of the climate change wars. I led the congressional delegation to Kyoto. I've been to several other UN COPs, including the one last year in Poland, and I'm planning on going to Copenhagen. The problem is that all of the discussions since Kyoto have been basically using the Kyoto construct and attempting to tweak Kyoto in a way to make it, quote, better, unquote. Kyoto is a flawed treaty. And the reason it's a flawed treaty is that it's not worldwide in application. Before the Kyoto Treaty was signed off on, the United States Senate unanimously passed a resolution saying they would not ratify a treaty that, number one, was not worldwide in application, and number two, which produced a significant harm to the United States economy. Kyoto flunked that test in both respects. And even though President Clinton signed the Kyoto Treaty, he never sent it to the Senate for ratification because he knew that the Senate would reject it. And the Constitution does require there to be a two-thirds vote for ratification. Now, since Kyoto, while the United States has not participated in one phase of the negotiations, the phase that came from the Rio Treaty, which we did ratify, the United States has been participants in, there has been an attempt to bring the revised treaty to have worldwide application. And the third world, led by China and India, have absolutely stonewalled that issue. And I've had bilateral meetings with Chinese and Indian representatives, and they have stated that they will never sign a treaty that commits their countries to internationally binding and verifiable cuts. So, in the last few weeks or so, there have been some newspapers, including The Economist in London, saying that it looks like a son of Kyoto coming out of Copenhagen will be the type of catastrophic failure that the former vice president is very fearful of. So the United States, and this is the Obama administration, has taken a different position. And I would just like to quote what Jonathan Pershing, who is the U.S. negotiator, said earlier this week in the last pre-Copenhagen session, which is going on as we speak in Bangkok. Quote, "We are not going to be in the Kyoto Protocol. We are not going to be part of an agreement that we cannot meet. We say a new agreement has to be signed by all countries. Things have changed since Kyoto. What our countries were in 1990 and today is very different. We cannot be struck with an agreement that's 20 years old. We want actions from all countries." Now, if China and India are not going to be in a Copenhagen treaty, it's also not ratifiable in the Senate. And Senator Kerry stated so in the Bali conference that was held almost 2 years ago. So what's the alternative plan? The alternative plan, in my opinion, is technology. In order to solve this problem, we need to reduce emissions on a worldwide basis. When you have cap and trade applying to some countries but not to others, together with a worldwide exchange of carbon offset credits, it ends up being a massive shift of wealth from countries that are capped and need to buy the credits to those that aren't capped have lots of credits to sell and can use the money to build new coal-fired power plants. And the Battelle Institute has indicated very clearly that even if first world emissions are reduced to zero by 2050, ton for ton there will be an increase in third world emissions. So what we need to do is to go the technology route. Now first, the timeline for technology can't be legislated. That is a definite non-starter.
second, if there is to be any type of capital attracted to developing new technologies, there has to be a vigorous enforcement of intellectual property rights. Because with no enforcement of IPR, you're never going to have people invest the money to develop these new technologies. And many of the third world countries have rotten records in terms of enforcing or recognizing IPR that have been developed elsewhere in the world. Now, I went to China with Speaker Pelosi, and the message I got is, sure, we're all for technology, but give it to us. Or if you don't give it to us, then give us a compulsory license at a very small fee, and we'll produce the new technology in our country rather than having it produced, being produced in the country where it's developed. And that means that technology is going to end up in a brick road. So I think that we're going to have to do two things in terms of the reality check. One is to recognize that the Kyoto Treaty is flawed and has failed, and not come out of Copenhagen with the son of Kyoto. And secondly, vigorously talk about innovation, but innovation coupled with enforceable intellectual property rights. And if we have that type of a marriage, I think we will see global emissions worldwide be reduced rather than being shifted from the first world to the third world, which is the result of Kyoto. So thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
On to Nancy Sutley, the new chairwoman of the Council on Foreign Relations. Council on Environmental Quality. I've been writing that for so long. So you've inherited the chair of Jim Conaton, and when you look out at this landscape, both domestic and international, what do you see again as the road to something that could be defined as meaningful in Copenhagen?
Well, I think I'd start with sort of how we define success and whether we I think the success in a question of an international negotiation isn't really the right question. The question is, are we successful in addressing the challenge that climate change poses to both the United States and to the rest of the world? And so looking at success as, are we reducing emissions of greenhouse gases, I think is how I would define success. So I think in both the domestic and the international front, certainly on the domestic front, we've got a kind of a lot of things going on right now, both in terms of what the administration is doing, investments in the Recovery Act of almost $80 billion in clean energy represents the most, the largest investment by the U.S. government in clean energy, in energy efficiency, and on things that will reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, create jobs, reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and stimulate this sector. I think the second is in terms of using existing authority, whether it's EPA and the greenhouse gas registry that the Vice President mentioned, whether it's appliance standards, appliance efficiency standards. The President just signed an executive order on sustainability in the federal government. It'll help to reduce the federal government's emissions. And then clearly the action in Congress, the passage of the bill in the House, the introduction of the draft by Senators Kerry and Boxer, I think will help to move the discussion along. I think that we're making progress, and the President continues to support and urge the Congress to pass a bill and to send it to him. So I think as far as the international negotiations go, I think the re-engagement of the United States in these discussions, I think the point that we should really be focused on emission reductions, and that the people who want to talk about it's it has to look like this or we failed, I think is kind of off in the wrong direction.
Just a really quick follow up with you. Your predecessor, if he were here, would probably say they never were disengaged. That in fact, the architecture that's emerging right now globally. Focus on major emitters, focus on discrete partnerships and sectors, focus on each country having its own individual commitments but done its own way was exactly what they've been pushing for years, and that's what essentially seems to be we're poised for in Copenhagen. So were they disengaged or not?
Well, I think what we've seen and what we've been doing since we came into office is actually making the commitments. And so it sort of you have to have both sides of this.
Okay. So Jim Rogers, who I recently quoted in Dot Earth, because you've referred to the challenge here as a sort of like cathedral building, which takes generations and sustained work and a vision. There's other, Thomas Berry had the similar idea that I wrote about. And here you are, a big power generating entity looking at changing things. So what's your view of the meaning of Copenhagen and what might make a difference there one way or the other from the atmosphere's point of view?
That's a good question, and I'm delighted to be here. And I would start out by being very clear with everyone here with respect to my carbon footprint. And I think I can define it with three numbers, 3, 12, 41. I'm the third of all companies in the U.S., I'm the third largest emitter of CO2. Of all companies in the world, I am the 12th largest emitter of CO2. And if we were one of the 192 countries in the United Nations, we would rank 41st. But Andy, I'm not applying for country status. I share that with you to say I view this as a daunting problem, and I see it through the eyes of our customers, because we're the third largest generator of electricity from coal. We're also the third largest generator of electricity from nuclear. And also, I say this to you, someone who in the early 90s joined with Vice President Gore with a voluntary reduction program. We basically have been reporting our emissions for over a decade, and we're focused on legislation getting done in the U.S. this year. I have been a strong advocate and was a founding member of U.S. CAP. And as Chairman Waxman said, one of the reasons they were able to reach agreement is in part because U.S. CAP, which represented major U.S. corporations, 5 major NGOs, presented with them with a blueprint that allowed them to work the process and deliver in China time almost a bill from the House. And as the Vice President said, we have a bill now, the carry a boxer carry bill, get them in the right order. And work is being done in the Senate. If I was king of the world, I would see action by our Congress before Copenhagen. Every day that goes by, the probability of that happening is reduced, unfortunately. But I still think that we can be successful in our country, can go there and really tick off a list of successes. They can tick off what's going on at the EPA, as the Vice President talked about. We can talk about what's going on in Congress. That's a tick in the box in terms of moving in the right direction. And even if it's not done this year, the conventional wisdom that's evolving in Washington is that we will have a bill by the first half of next year. I'm not making any predictions because I've been such an advocate for getting it done this year, and I'm not giving up on that possibility, although the probability goes down, as I mentioned, every day. Also, I've had the good fortune to chair the Edison Electric Institute, which represents all the investor-owned utilities in the country, and that while I was chair, we changed our position to support the regulation of carbon. That is really critical, and one of the reasons that the Waxman-Markey bill went through so quick is because the industry that produces 40% of the emissions in this country supported regulation of carbon. And I think that is one of those messages that can also be taken to Copenhagen, that you have a major sector that is supporting it, and you have major corporate support across the country and growing support in communities and states across our country. Now, what the question is, what happens at Copenhagen? And my hope is that we're able to create a roadmap forward. It's not clear what happens. I'm part of the Copenhagen counselors, our climate counselors. I've been to Copenhagen 3 times in the last year, really working to try to set the stage for success there. But I will leave you with one provocative thought, and that's this. Because I can't predict what would happen in the Congress, nor will I predict what will happen in Copenhagen. But if I could imagine myself as Connie Hedegaard, who is a minister of the environment, who has been a tireless advocate for getting it done in Copenhagen, I would go there and work hard to establish a roadmap. I would work hard to establish a 2050 goal line that everybody agrees to. I would push as hard as I could to get as much done as I could get done. And then if it wasn't enough, I would simply say to all the countries that are there that here in Denmark, we have made the transition. Our economy is very successful. We're one of the lowest carbon emitting per capita any country in the world. And I'm going to give y'all an assignment. I want you to go home and go to work. And by the way, U.S., get that legislation passed if it didn't pass. And China, and by the way, people don't understand. They get caught up in the rhetoric of what is said in China. But the reality is, if you look at the actual behavior of the Chinese, they're behaving more than we are in this country in terms of getting prepared to live in a low-carbon world. They lead the world with solar. They lead the world in wind turbines. Their battery development is leading the world. They're building 14 nuclear plants and 10 more on the drawing board with zero greenhouse gases. They are actually, on China time, putting their money where they're being careful in how they say it. But at the end of the day, look at actions to me speak louder than words. And in our country, we're a little more the chattering class rather than what the Chinese appear to be as the can-do class. And as I'm talking as Connie now. And I would basically say, U.S., go get the legislation passed. I believe that China and the U.S. are the key to the development of a technology roadmap. I believe you'll scale CCS faster in China than you will in the U.S. It's critical to both of our countries. 80% of their electricity comes from coal. 50% of ours comes from coal in the U.S. And I would say to China and the U.S., take the next 5 or 6 months, sit down, work your way through this, work together, build a ladder of cooperation and trust, and come back in June, and let's get this done. Because Denmark has the capability to convene all of next year. So I would put it to them, and I would say, we are going to get this done this year. Go do your homework. See you in June.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you. So to Jane Lubchenco, the scientist on the panel here, who has now entered the world of the administration.
The dark side.
Oh, well, do you think so? Can you? Well, you wouldn't have done this, I assume, if you thought you couldn't get anything done. So even though there's darkness and complexity and all that congressional blah, 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 and maybe a bang, you know, why have you taken the step, and what do you see as where we're at and with Copenhagen, too?
So I think the blah, 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 bang is a good point to tee off on, Andy. And I want to pick up on that and also something that Vice President Gore said, which was systems being characterized by tipping points. And I am of the firm opinion that social systems are characterized by tipping points. We've seen major 180-degree shifts in people's attitudes toward things that for a long time to many seemed impossible. Attitudes toward smoking, attitudes toward drunk driving, civil rights, women's suffrage are a few examples. And I believe there is very good evidence that you can be making significant progress towards some meaningful change without that progress being obvious. And then you hit the tipping point. and things can change very rapidly. The problem I see with climate change is that there are multiple tipping points in the system, in the social systems, not the biogeophysical system, but in our social systems. And it's not just blah, 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 bang. I think we are have reached a tipping point that is blah, 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 okay, I get it. But we haven't yet reached the next tipping point, which is agreement on how to address the problem. So I think it's useful that to recognize that, in fact, we are approaching the end game, I think, but we're not there yet. And I believe that to your question as to why I came out of the academic world to serve a role in government as the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, part of it is my belief that this administration it represents an opportunity to get to those tipping points and to significantly make very meaningful changes that will benefit the American people as well as the world. And scientific evidence, which is my world, has been extremely helpful and useful, both the social science and the natural science, in getting us to this first tipping point of, okay, I get it. I think there is increasing recognition on the part of Americans and the rest of the world that climate change is important and we need to address it. So we've actually made significant progress in that. Instead of denial, there is agreement that it's real, not unanimous agreement, but a major shift in public attitudes about it. But the next question, which is relevant to Copenhagen, is, okay, now what do we do about it? And that's the very complex landscape that we are addressing today. And the question is, how much will we have those answers in time for Copenhagen? Jim has suggested that perhaps we need to think beyond Copenhagen, that that's not the only opportunity to be making significant changes. The need for scientific information, both natural and social sciences, to continue to inform our understanding is one of the responsibilities that the federal government has and that we take very seriously. And so in addition to participating actively in international scientific assessments, such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the federal family is actively working toward, and individual agencies are actively working toward, understanding the system better and sharing that information more broadly in ways that are credible, relevant, understandable. And an example of that is a report that we released recently about how climate change is already impacting the United States, region by region and sector by sector. And this information, I think, is extremely important in helping citizens and their elected representatives, as well as private sector and others, to understand not just what's happening, but what is at risk and what the opportunities are to make meaningful changes. So I see this through the lens of a scientist and through the lens of a member of this administration, where there is so much opportunity, but there's so much that needs to be done. Science needs to underpin that. But again, coming back to these tipping points, what are the actions that are needed to get us to the tipping point of making some meaningful changes at the global scale? The science is so compelling. This is urgent. There are more players engaged in the dialogue. It's not just about the science anymore. The private sector is engaged. Faith-based communities are engaged. Youth is engaged. There is more and more momentum. We need to get on with acting.
Great. Well, you've given me a theme to blog on now. Dot, 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 I get it. I mean, blah, 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 I get it. That's good. That's as good as Big Fat Female Fish, which I... that's for another day. I'd like to start having people assemble if they want to ask questions. We don't have a lot of time. We have close to a half hour. So, and again, journalists first, and identify yourself. I'm going to ask one quick one, though. So much of this, an issue like climate is framed as a debate and articulated from the edges of the discourse, which is very normal in our political realm as well. It's all this sort of push me, pull you thing. When I see signs of consensus on something, I pay attention because it's such a rare thing, at least to have it articulated. Al Gore and Congressman Sensenbrenner both spoke about innovation. No matter what's done with efficiency or whatever, you still need the second half, which is breakthroughs. And for, I guess, the three middle... Well, actually, you too, Xinghua. What merits do you all see in what was articulated here a minute ago about the need for innovation and protecting ideas as we go forward? So as we share, what would realistically produce the breakthroughs you need? Like, if you want to capture CO2 and have your coal and climate too, and how do you protect the value in that, or is it a public good that we should just sort of give away, as Steve Chu said on Dot Earth a little while ago?
Well, the issue on innovation is whether it will work from a market standpoint, meaning you got to drive down the cost per unit, and people will actually want to use the innovation because it will save them money. Now, I've been involved in the whole debate on climate change for a long time. And we hear an awful lot about scientific consensus. What we don't talk about is the economic impact. And I'm the only elected official, I think, that is talking to this conference. One of the things that our voters look at is what goes into their pockets and what comes out of their pockets. And the economic impact of the cap and trade legislation, whether it's domestically or whether it's a part of a Kyoto Treaty or a post-Kyoto Treaty, is devastating, particularly in the so-called Rust Belt, where we're heavily dependent upon coal for electric generating. We don't have very many nuclear plants in most places in the upper Midwest. And having the increases in electric rates, which have been estimated at about 50% under the Waxman-Markey bill, will simply make the manufacturing that is still going on in the upper Midwest non-competitive, particularly against goods that are imported from places like China and India. You know, this is the concern that we have, because people who lose their jobs based upon actions that we may vote for aren't going to be voting for us again.
So I don't want to interrupt, but I want to stay on the point of how do you spur the innovation to make solar panels as cheap as paint so that they become competitive then? And, you know, do you see... Is it direct federal investment in R&D, or is it...
The answer is no. You know, it's got to be private investment in R&D. And instead of having the government pick winners and losers based upon money that the government would come out, you know, give them tax credits. You know, I've been an advocate of making the R&D tax credit permanent, which the Ways and Means Committee never seems to get around to. So it goes on for a while and then expires, and nobody can really make long-term economic decisions if all of a sudden a tax credit that is here today is gone tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Andy, may I just comment on this, because a technology roadmap is really critical. Every way we make electricity in this country, if it's going to be an equal contributor in a low-carbon world, needs technological advances to be an equal contributor. So we have to be careful to avoid picking technologies, but they all need advances. One of the reasons our company entered into two memorandums of understanding, one with China Huanan Group, which is the largest generator of electricity in China, and the other is with ENN, who is doing research on algae and smart grid. They're the largest independent energy company. It's because we see in this corporation the ability to scale and deploy CCS faster. We see the opportunities to work together and develop technologies faster, because at the end of the day, it is technology that's going to make a difference. And for a company like ours, where every power plant we own and operate today, by 2050, will be retired and replaced, the sooner we get about the innovation and the development of the technology, the quicker we can go to work and get the planning and the work done to actually make it a reality.
Nancy, and then Shayla.
Yeah, I think it's a few things. One is, you know, with the Recovery Act, the president said, you know, we need to both invest immediately to help to stimulate our economy, but we also have to make long-term, set the foundation for our long-term investments, our long-term strategy. So the clean energy, the $80 billion for clean energy and energy efficiency and the environment, and focused not just on government grants, but also on loan guarantees and tax credits, and make the investment in R&D. So that's on the sort of the Recovery Act side. I think in terms of these agreements, these international agreements, some of them bilateral, U.S. and China, Secretary Chu announced a partnership with the Chinese on energy technology. The U.S. And the Australians and some, I think, 21 other countries, a partnership on carbon capture and sequestration. But I think probably most importantly, the long-term investment signal of a price on carbon will help to drive the innovation that we need. And we know that, sort of picking on the Chinese, but we know how much, first of all, that the government will, once they focus on a problem, they'll spend whatever money it takes in their view, to solve the problem, and they are doing that right now on clean energy, that the spending in China is in the hundreds of millions of dollars every year on renewable energy, and that we are in danger of losing the technology race unless we take advantage of both the things that we can do now under the Recovery Act, but also to put a price on carbon.
Natural segue to China. So quick thought from
China. Sure, definitely. Quickly, 2 points. One is government incentives will be the key. And, of course, government doesn't have all the money to support everything, but it's very important for government to take the first step in that incentives. That could include the public funding as well as, you know, subsidies, incentives, other stuff. Because by only having that, you'll be able to drive, actually, technology innovation to attract the private capital flows as well as market there. The second point I want to make is that this is kind of happening, which is encouraging, actually. More and more countries' governments are starting to see the investment in clean technology or clean energy technology down the road in the future as a strategic advantage. And China is seeing it that way. The U.S. is a similar thing. Just the last point to make a little bit, and compare to our two countries, actually, we are going sort of different directions, and China probably, the government is doing too much, and we have a lot of lessons to learn, and the government definitely sees it and wants to do it, but there are more domestic barriers out there within the system that's kind of blocking, you know, the enforcement or implementation of those ambitious visions and the policies at this moment. We don't have time to share more. I could share with you if you are interested in later. Thank you.
Okay. There was a post on Dot Earth a while back with a longer interview with you too. So there's more there. Let's go to a question and say who you are. And it's not working. There it goes. Say
Hi.
Who you are. And all that.
My name is Kathy Florsheim. I'm a freelance documentary photographer, and my question is for Mr. Rogers. And Andy, I want to borrow your mantle. I'm going to pretend I'm the atmosphere for a moment, and I'm going to ask you, sir, if I take you seriously in your description of Copenhagen, how does that mesh with what you're telling me about your company as the third worst CO2 producer? What are you doing to change that?
Well, first and foremost, we have developed a plan to shut down 4,500 megawatts of old coal plants over time. But as I said earlier, my job one for me is affordable, reliable electricity 24/7, 365. And so I have to balance affordability, reliability, and clean as we make this transition to a low-carbon world. But let me quickly tell you what we're doing. In North Carolina, we have a program where we're actually investing, installing, and operating solar on the rooftop and actually giving a lease payment to the homeowner or the business. That's a for instance. We put $1 billion in wind. We have 5,000 megawatts under development in 14 states across the country. So we're really trying to develop a wind portfolio. We're building biomass with the French. We have the joint venture with respect to Areva. We've got two nuclear plants on the drawing board because that is the only technology today you can produce electricity 24/7 with zero greenhouse gases. And lastly, and this is the one that kind of people go, oh my goodness, how can you be for reduction in carbon and be building two coal plants? And the answer is very simple. We're building a co-gasification plant in Indiana, which is the largest in the world. We're going to do CCS there because it's building the minefields. We're putting $2.3 billion in, and this is going to be the largest CCS project attached to a power plant in the world. One of the reasons we did the deal with Huanan Group in China is they have a thing called GreenGen, where it's very similar but smaller scale, and we're going to try to learn to really accelerate because we need to learn to use coal with, before it will be clean, we have to get the carbon out. And if even if we did it and didn't develop the technology, and we walked away from coal and didn't use it, the Chinese, 80% of their electricity comes from coal, so that technology must get developed, whether it's sequestered or whether we reuse it. So as a consequence of building these two coal plants, which are going to represent about 1,400 megawatts of new generation, we're going to shut down about 1,500 megawatts with a much larger SOx-NOx mercury footprint, and the carbon intensity of our product, because of the efficiency of the new units, will be reduced dramatically, and we will cap our CO2 emissions as a consequence of it. More to say about this, but that was sort of a Pony Express list, because at the end of the day, it's one thing to work on the Hill, and I spent 3 days on the Hill this week helping trying to get Congress moving and get good legislation out. But we are making investment decisions, and we're operating today as if climate legislation is already passed. We put a price on carbon. We build it into how we make decisions. And as a company, we believe that it's inevitable. We get the science, and we're behaving in a way consistent as if Congress had already passed it and as if Copenhagen was done.
Okay. So over here and then over to that mic.
Good. A question for Chenghua Wu. Chenghua, you stated that China and India have proposed more ambitious targets than the United States for CO2 emissions, I believe under Copenhagen. And therefore is looking, and not only China, but all other nations are looking to the U.S. for what it will propose. And I believe Representative Sensenbrenner stated that under no circumstances would China nor India accept binding mandatory limits to their CO2 emissions. My question to you, what will it take to convince China or any Chinese policymaker to accept eventually any binding mandatory caps or limits to any emissions of any greenhouse gas?
Thank you for the question. First, a correction. I did not mean that China and India have made more commitments into the Copenhagen process. It's different because in the UNFCCC as well as Kyoto Protocol process, there are some fundamental principles there that all the countries have to follow. And in their particular common but differentiated responsibility, I sound more like a Chinese leading negotiator now. They have paired me with that. I think actually today, if you look at it, to be fair, China and India has come along in the last few months as well. Let me focus on China first. China has been doing so much. It's part of the difference of the culture. Chinese tends to do more than say more. So we do things, actually. So you don't really hear Chinese officials talking about that too much. But the situation has changed a little bit in the last couple of 1 year or so after Bali process. Chinese realized that the decision makers realized they have to let the international community understand what the country has been doing. And I think more and more, particularly from this part of the world, we started to see people's recognition of China's contribution and efforts in reducing, shifting away from fossil fuels, reducing the emissions of carbon or avoiding, reduce the amount of emissions, stuff like that. Where we stuck at this moment internationally is really the principles and in the Kyoto process of UNFCCC. Back to what Senator said, actually, I was sitting here just wondering, that's exactly where we are today. There is a tricky line there, and You know, when it's international convention, there are certain principles that should need to be followed, abide by. This is more like a game to play. So when you bring people around the table, say we're going to play this, we have certain rules to follow in the beginning, then we follow that. It's really, really hard, actually. In the middle of the game, you say, oops, actually, we don't like the rules anymore. We have to change. Because if you need to understand deeper. In this country, actually, this is the world's largest economy. You know, you have more advanced technology, everything that, like that. People here, politicians here, are concerned about the impact on the economic development here in this country already. Just imagine countries like China, India, and many others, actually, who have to continue to grow because we still have so many people living in poverty at this moment. And so, to a large extent, development, mitigation, adaptation combined together is more significant, actually, for developing countries probably than here. And so it's more urgent for developing countries like China, India, to take actions, not necessarily, you know, for the first priority for the climate change, but really for their own sake at this moment. They just have to do it. So back to the question, say, what would it take to the Copenhagen process to have China, India to put, I don't know what we mean, targets, because at this moment, China has been making effort, you know, commitment in terms of energy intensity, and the President Hu Jintao actually a couple of weeks ago in New York said we're looking into carbon intensity targets. India probably would do along the same line. This is more like domestic efforts. But you say, okay, China, India, you have to play exactly the same role, say, like the US, EU, others put a cap on your emissions. I just, particularly for the Copenhagen process in 2 months, I don't see that as realistic at all.
Congressman, quickly.
One of the problems is that China particularly, and to a lesser extent India, want to have a different regime of counting reductions than they are asking the rest of the world to do. And in my visits to China and my discussions with Chinese officials, they say they wish to reduce their carbon emissions per GDP by 20% measured over the five-year period from 2005 to 2010. Now, the Chinese GDP is slated to grow, even in these tough world economic times, by 50% between 2005 and 2010. So if they achieve that target, they still have a growth rate of 30% over their 2005 targets. Now, meantime, the Chinese are demanding that the United States reduce its total emissions, not per GDP, but total emissions, to 40% below 1990 levels. Now, the economic impact of this is a huge plus for China and the Chinese economy and a huge minus for the American economy and, by implication, the economy of the European Union. And a lot of this debate, and I get back to the issue of we're talking about economics, is not about the environment, but about jobs and wealth and where they are. And when you have a democratic political system of representative government, which most of the world has, but China does not, you are asking elected representatives who have to account for their votes to their constituencies to vote for a construct like that. And believe me, there's nobody that would support an elected politician that does that. And that's why things have got to be politically realistic, and we're not talking about politically realistic issues here with these kinds of accounting mechanisms on the table.
Over here, before you start, though, I have to note that that accounting architecture China has proposed, this, the carbon intensity metric, was brought to the table by the Bush administration as the way we should be measuring our progress. So they're actually adopting our strategy, I guess. Over here.
Peter Annan from the Institutes for Journalism and Natural Resources. Some of the speakers touched on this a little bit in their opening remarks, but I'd be curious to just, if we could quickly go down the line, including the moderator, actually, Andy, not to put you on the spot, to see what people think the chances are of success or not, or an actual agreement out of Copenhagen.
Well, that gets back at Nancy's question about how you define success, which could lead to a
problem. How about this, a concrete agreement?
Yeah, there's still some wiggle room there. But anyway, start at that end. Moderator's prerogative. Because I don't want to pop the bubble before it's been inflated.
I'm very hopeful there will be an agreement, but what it is remains to be defined. That's what the negotiations are all about.
Yeah.
It would be a much higher probability of agreement in Copenhagen if the U.S. would have acted before Copenhagen, because we have to really lead on this issue in order to get a meaningful agreement coming out of Copenhagen. So as I said a moment ago, every day that goes by, the probability of U.S. action is lower, although we have a great track record of things we've done. And as I said a few moments ago when I was trying to be provocative and pretend I was Connie, I think, quite frankly, we're going to leave there with a lot of work to do. But hopefully we have a roadmap, hopefully have a 2050 sort of goal line, and a commitment to find a way.
Well, I think that I'm optimistic we'll know what we need to do once we leave Copenhagen. And I think that we've certainly been making a lot of effort throughout the year to try to define what that is. So whether it's in the formal UN negotiation process or through the G8 or the G20 or the strategic dialogue with China and bilateral discussions with many countries to try to define a way that we know coming out of Copenhagen what we need to do.
If there is an agreement that the Kyoto Treaty was flawed and the Kyoto process has failed in the last 12 years, then Copenhagen can be useful in terms of a roadmap for future negotiations. However, if all that is expected and the UN works by consensus, is that Kyoto be tweaked, then anything that comes out of Copenhagen will be a blank piece of paper. And that's not to say that all of the world leaders will hold up a blank piece of paper and smile and say, look what we did, applause, please.
I keep my moderate optimism in it. I think there is going to be something agreed. And if you look at the negotiation process, certain details actually moving towards that direction. In the meantime, I think there are going to be a lot of blanks there and waiting to continue to be negotiated leading up to next year. Hopefully by May or fall 2010, more details will be worked out.
Yeah, there was a false sense of expectation coming out of the Bali meeting 2 years ago that this could be wrapped up. Realists, like you've heard here, even then Eileen Claussen and others were saying, you know, it would be too rushed to think you could ever get some kind of comprehensive new treaty by this year. So whatever comes out of this process will be, I think, the best case, you know, from the standpoint of the atmosphere, not the standpoint of a reporter, is some discrete agreements on some achingly intense issues that divide parties hugely, one of which is the unfulfilled commitment of rich countries to provide funding for poor countries to adapt to climate risk. That is the thing that will kill this process in Copenhagen before anything else. There are countries who are ready to walk out on the process. The president of Ethiopia has made clear, the African Union has said, you know, we're out of here if we don't see something finally after nearly 20 years of that commitment coming. So it's, don't even think about the cap and trading or post-Kyoto, just those kinds of deals. If there isn't substantive movement on adaptation assistance and on technology transfer, then that will be a sign. The atmosphere will be sitting there going, oh dang, there's a lot more of this stuff coming.
But Andy, I would just drop one sort of footnote to your point. Avoided deforestation is really a critical issue to Brazil, Indonesia, and a lot of these countries in Africa. And if we could find some way, because we didn't at Kyoto, we ignored avoided deforestation. Right. If we could find a way to kind of get that on there as a legitimate approach, and it's embedded in
the word legitimate there is a very important word, too.
How do you verify, et cetera.
Verifiable, all that stuff. We have time for one more question, I've been told. So we'll come over here. Say who you are and...
Hi, Peter Thompson from Public Radio International Program of the World in Boston. This is for all of you, but I'm particularly interested in Jane and maybe even Andy's response to this. Without dismissing the political and the diplomatic and economic challenges to reaching agreement in Copenhagen and beyond, here in the U.S., a huge problem, obviously, is political will. And political will, of course, is dependent on understanding of the problem.
I was just told that's not a problem.
I think probably people here would disagree with that. Political will is, of course, based on the understanding of an agreement on the problem. And stepping back even one step further, that comes down to a question of understanding the science. And obviously, we have a big problem with scientific literacy in this country. I think we also have a problem with an ideological engagement with the science, or refusal to engage with the science, in that many people don't like where they think the science is pointing in terms of policy outcomes, and so they challenge or ignore the science. And I'm wondering, as head of one of the government's leading scientific agencies and a major voice in the media and engaging with the public on this, how you are dealing with those challenges of increasing public literacy, but also just public engagement with real science and trying to diminish the ideological resistance to dealing with the science.
I think for a long time, many Americans thought that if climate change was actually happening, it was sort of someplace else and way down the road. And I think the new scientific information that that we now have at hand articulates very strongly that climate change is happening now, and that it's affecting the United States. It's affecting many sectors of the United States, and that it's not just about polar bears or sea level rise for islands in the Pacific, not to undermine the importance of those. But for most Americans, you know, what they care about is their world and how they see their world. And I think that there is increasingly powerful scientific information that is pretty convincing that it is real, it's happening now, and it's affecting the things we care about. The challenge is having mechanisms to communicate that in ways that are relevant to and believable to people. Reports like the one that I highlighted are a very first step, but they are not enough. There have to be other mechanisms for sharing that information. And what I see is the increasingly powerful voices of the private sector saying, we get it, we need to be part of the solution, we need some certainty so that we can move ahead. From the faith-based communities, with many religions saying, this is a moral issue, we need to address this. From youth who are saying, we're going to inherit this mess, let's get on with it. So I think we're seeing part of this movement toward tipping points that tees off from the science, but isn't really about the science. It's about people's lives and how their lives and the things that people care about are going to be affected. The time that it takes for that to penetrate to decision makers is part of the challenge here, because it takes a while for that message to get through. And, you know, this administration came in with a commitment to address climate change, a commitment to make decisions based on solid science. But the time between January and Copenhagen is very short to be able to make the kinds of changes that we all think are actually needed. So the science is there. The science is powerful. We're doing exploring ways to make it more accessible and relevant. And the focus is, I believe, not just on the need to reduce emissions, but increasingly the importance of what Andy mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and that is addressing the realities that we're going to need to adapt to climate change that is already underway. And what is that going to look like? Within NOAA, we provide a lot of climate services in terms of information. We and other federal agencies are interested in providing a much broader suite of climate services, not unlike what NOAA does for the National Weather Service, in terms of ongoing, accessible, understandable information that you can use to make decisions. And we believe that that's a commitment that we need to make, grounded in solid science, but providing information so that farmers can plan, so businesses can plan, so city managers, water resource managers, anyone who is, you know, making plans 20, 30 years, it's not just 100 years down the road, and it's not just the whole globe. it's actually the things that Americans care about that is at risk.
Okay, I'll put on my pundit hat or whatever that is. I think the issues are much more profound than that. I'd like to be as optimistic as that. But Mike, there's a guy, a climate scientist in England, Mike Hulme, H-U-L-M-E, who wrote this book called Why We Disagree About Climate Change, which I quoted him in 2007 in a story on why we disagree about climate change. And he makes some very powerful points. He says, your question was framed around the need, the presumption that new scientific information will magically make ideological disagreements disappear. Let's not get into the debate. But what he says is the frames of reference are there. They exist. People looking at the same body of science now have a completely different definition of what climate change is. What is this global warming thing? There's a chunk of our country, 20% of people, an enduring, powerful chunk of people, absolutely reject that there is a possibility humans will dangerously disrupt climate. 20% absolutely subscribe to Al Gore's view of the world, and the rest of us are disengaged, doubtful, or otherwise occupied. And that isn't going to change on the basis necessarily of new information. So what you do then is you say, well, what is the actual problem here? And the actual problem, if it relates to energy insufficiency, meaning we don't have the menu of energy options to take a world that's 85% dependent on fossil fuels and head it toward 9 billion people, adding two more Chinas by 2050, and decarbonizing it at the same time. We do, you know, turning off the lights is not going to do that. So that's what leads me in my own reporting repeatedly back to innovation, technology, what actually makes innovation happen, what is sort of doesn't. I look at the new ARPA-E program, and I see transformational money going to a proposal to harvest heat from parking lots. That, if that's transformational energy technology, that doesn't strike me as the revolution that's required. So that's the kind of focus I think we all as journalists need to kind of cut to the root and see if you believe climate change is a significant problem or that the world doesn't have its energy choices it needs with 2 billion people cooking on firewood, what would actually make a difference and how long would it take for that to happen? So that's my thought.
And it's like Representative Stenson, but I'm used to.
Well, let me just very briefly say is where there's been a disconnect in this entire debate over the last 30 years is melding the science with the economics. I have known the former vice president since we were both in the House and had lockers across from each other in the gym, and I was the chairman of the science committee for 4 years at the end of the last decade. And we're going to be talking in two different worlds, literally, until we meld the science and the economics. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who have been proponents of doing something about climate change, led by Al Gore, really don't talk very much about the economics because there will be some major economic changes as a result of this. And we're not going to get very far, and I don't think that there's going to be legislation that means much in the whole area passed by the Congress during this two-year session of Congress, until people are convinced that doing something about climate change is going to benefit them economically. And when we're talking about increases in electric prices, increases in natural gas prices, increases in prices of gas at the pump, those are kind of fighting words, particularly in a recessionary economy.